Hey guys, how's it going, man? Welcome to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Okay, guys, it's summer fun drive time at The Scott Horton Show. Bills are piling up and equipment is wearing out. So here's the deal. Anyone who donates $50 or more gets a chance to win a week's vacation for two to Costa Rica. Drawing is July 15th. Winner, go whenever you want. See more details at scotthorton.org/raffle. Anyone who donates $100 or more gets entered into the raffle, plus a 1-ounce silver QR code commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com. And the first 25 people to donate $100 or more will also get a copy of Your Money or Your Life, Why We Must Abolish the Income Tax by Sheldon Richman, or the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me, for free. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate or scotthorton.org/raffle for details. You can also sign up for monthly donations by way of PayPal, per interview at Patreon, support with Bitcoin, and shop through scotthorton.org/Amazon. And thanks. All right, y'all, welcome back. Yeah, I should have a little bumper music in and out on the end of that thing, huh? Oh, well. So I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, The Scott Horton Show. It's libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Which means I hate the government, and which means I hate the things that are the worst about it the most. You know, the wars. And all the lies that go with the wars. So many wars and lies to keep up with. Well, that's why I'm here daily, noon to two. On the Liberty Radio Network for you here. Sorry for the lousy production values, but hey, it is what it is. Seems like pretty obvious, and yet I'm the only one who does this, pretty much. I'm also on Sunday mornings on KPFK in Los Angeles. If you live in Southern California, you can hear that damn thing from basically from Arizona to out past Catalina Island, from Mexico up to Santa Barbara. It's badass at KPFK, 90.7 FM in LA. And they got repeaters everywhere too, in Ridgecrest and China Lake, up in Santa Barbara and wherever, all over Southern California every Sunday morning at 8:30 KPFK in LA. And then, UC Davis plays me and UC Riverside plays me on their shows. Really ought to work harder on trying to get things. Oh, and you know what? I never do mention this, but, actually, apparently, according to the manager of KPFK, I asked him one time, and he knows how to find this out, I guess. He went and looked it up and said that, no, my shows get played on Pacifica stations all across America, sometimes in D.C., in Houston, in I think up in Madison, and KPFA in San Francisco from time to time. And he sent me a list. There are a lot more Pacifica stations than I knew there were. And he sent me a list and said, well, these guys seem to play every week, and these guys seem to play every once in a while, and that kind of thing. So that's pretty cool, man. I didn't even know that. It's not like they're paying me or anything, but that's all right. I mean, not really. I would like money. But I'm happy that they're playing the show. So there you go, Pacifica. I'm on Pacifica, and I'm here on the Liberty Radio Network. Call it the realignment. All right. Hey man, I'm really proud of this. I did an audiobook of one of Lou Rockwell's books. And it's great. The book is all about a bunch of horrible fascists and a bunch of heroic libertarian capitalists. It's called Fascism versus Capitalism. It's a very Lou Rockwellian kind of a thing, I think you'll find when you read it. And you can find the audio version now on Amazon.com. At audible.com, and I guess at iTunes, although I tried to look. I guess I didn't look on my actual iTunes. I looked on the internet, but I should open up my iTunes and see if I can find it that way. But anyway, soon enough, anyway, it'll be on iTunes. And yeah, it's a great read. I had fun reading it, even though I had to read it out loud. It was a lot harder to get real good takes of everything. Hopefully there's no screw-ups in there. Let me know if you find any. It was a lot of work, a lot more than I thought it was going to be. But, yeah, it was cool, man. So maybe someday if I ever write a book, then I'll do my own dang audiobook. That should be easier, right? If I wrote the script myself. All right. Well, anyway, so it's now on sale. Brand new out. Took forever. So under the labor theory of value, it's worth a lot. Under the subjective theory of value, I hope you believe that it's worth actually nothing. All you got to do is sign up for audibletrial.com/Scott Horton Show, and you can get it for free if you want. Or you can spend money on it. You can find the link at the bottom. I didn't put it above my actual paying advertisers, but down there at the bottom of the page on the right-hand side at scotthorton.org, you can find the link there to the audiobook narrated by me of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism. I think you'll like it. And, yeah, the vacation to Costa Rica. Someone said to me, you know, you're not making it clear enough that people can go whenever they want. The drawing is going to be on July the 15th. And then whoever wins the trip for two to Costa Rica, you can go whenever you want. You can go the next day, or you can go in August, or you can go in September. You can go for Christmas or whatever you want. They're going to be down there. In fact, that'd probably be a nice way to spend Christmas. You do whatever you want with it. Go at the beginning of next summer if you want. I don't care. And Joshua Hughes, your host, doesn't care either. So, you know, do what you like. So I'm glad I made that clear. And yeah, it's a fun drive, and I'm trying to raise some money, and you can get a QR code disc, silver commodity code, QR code disc. You scan it with your phone. It tells you how much it's worth in real time, which I think is cool. That's if you donate 100 or more, you get a raffle ticket and one of those. And also, if you donate $100 or more while supplies last, you can get a free copy of the audiobook of Fascism versus Capitalism, or a copy of the actual Dead Tree version of the book, Your Money or Your Life, The Case Against the Income Tax by the heroic Sheldon Richman. So that is a pretty damn good deal, don't you think? Of course it is. So stop by scotthorton.org/raffle, scotthorton.org/donate, and find out all about that. Oh, yeah. And by the way, I'm always flipping my pen around and dropping it on the desk while I'm on the radio. Sorry. And I'm also always looking for new advertisers on the show. So let me know if you own a business or some kind of nonprofit group or whatever the heck it is you want to help support. Then let me know about that. Scott@scotthorton.org. Scott@scotthorton.org. That's my email address. Try to work something out, man. I got relatively affordable prices, I think you'll find. Cool. Also, by the way, today, I got a radio show coming up. I got Jerome Slater. He's going to be on to talk about the United Nations report on the most recent war in Gaza that came out yesterday. I wrote a thing up about it for Mondo Weiss. And also, the great Gareth Porter is going to be here to talk about Kerry's climb down and then climb back up. John Kerry. On the possible military dimensions. Which is a red herring within the gigantic red herring of Iran's nuclear program. And on the other side of this break coming up here, I'm going to do a little bit of coverage on the Iran nuclear issue myself for you here. There's a New York Times article needs debunking, and I don't want to waste too much of Gareth Porter's time with it. It's Alan Cooperman, the guy that wrote the great thing at Boston.com about a false pretense for war in Libya back in 2011. Great one. And then he wrote that thing in Foreign Affairs. We didn't have that good of an interview the second time, if I remember right, but he wrote a pretty good thing in Foreign Affairs about how shouldn't have done Libya. Remember him? Horrible on Iran in today's New York Times. We'll be right back.
So you're a libertarian, and you don't believe the propaganda about government awesomeness you were subjected to in fourth grade. You want real history and economics. Well, learn in your car from professors you can trust with Tom Woods's Liberty Classroom. And if you join through the Liberty Classroom link at scotthorton.org, we'll make a donation to support The Scott Horton Show. Liberty Classroom, the history and economics they didn't teach you.
Hey, Al, Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. If this nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone, we are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at scotthorton.org or thewarstate.com.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show.
Oh, man, I forgot to tweet out today's show. I forgot to post on liberty.me. Today's show, Jerome Slater and Gareth Porter. Tomorrow, Mark Thornton. And, you know, I'm sorry, I really ought to do a better job of getting the Austrians on to talk about gold. It's so important that we have sound money. Other than the Congress that created it, the central bank, man, it's the cause of all other horrible things. No Fed, no Pentagon. Simple as that. Gotta have sound money to end the empire. Well, yeah. Anyway. Something like that. And our good friend Mark Thornton is going to be on from the Ludwig von Mises Institute to talk all about that. And, well, and some other things. Should be good. I am Scott Horton. This is my show, The Scott Horton Show. Libertarian foreign policy, mostly. Drop by the chat room. I've got some pretty small group of guys in there today. You could help enlarge the group. ScottHorton.org/chat. It's an IRC free node chat. Hashtag Scott Horton Show. Just like everything else. Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. Hey, retweet me. Tell your people to tune into the show. Twitter.com/ScottHortonShow. You can follow me on there. Beware, I might insult you. I'm a very hateful, cranky person. Yeah. All right. Yeah, so I guess the Cooperman thing. I don't want to waste Gareth's time with this later, but I do want to talk about it, so I guess here we go. Alan Cooperman, who was good on Libya. Boy, here he is, just blowing it here on Iran in the New York Times. The Iran deal's fatal flaw. He says Obama's main pitch for the pending nuclear deal with Iran is that it would extend the breakout time necessary for Iran to produce enough enriched uranium for a nuclear weapon. In a current interview on NPR, he said that the current breakout time is about 2 to 3 months, but at the end of the deal, the breakout time will be lengthened to longer than a year. And then he goes on and makes a quite dubious case to say that that's just not right. And he redefines a lot of terms in order to make that not right. And I'll get into that in just a second. But here's the real thing. The premise of the entire article is that the Iranians are just trying to find a way to make a nuclear bomb here. That's all they're doing. There's actually a lot of unsaid and unproven premises to this article, too. Like, it would make sense for them to dash out to grab, to sneak out or dash out to break the NPT and the safeguards agreement and the whole deal and to try to sneak out or dash out to a nuclear bomb, but just to make one. That this whole thing really is just kind of a put on. So that they can bide their time. He actually ends up saying at the end of the deal, the breakout time will have been reduced to a few days under his estimates. Again, based on all his premises. And yet, in the year 2030, after they've continued to not make a nuclear bomb for another 15 years, then they might, when the deal is up. That's the best scare argument you got? Is that this will leave some nuclear infrastructure in place. And then when the deal is over, they'll be able to expand it. And then they might make a nuke. Huh. Well, that doesn't seem like a very good deal, argument. How about, you know, when we're at 25 years, we try to negotiate to extend the deal, maybe. If everything's going fine,
in the year 2025, you know, then we can work on extending it a little more. And then, well, hang on, I got Gordon Prather in my email right now, nuclear weapons physicist and a friend of mine. Watch. He just says, this guy's a nothing. He's not a scientist. He doesn't know anything, so forget it, basically. Old Gordon, he ain't got no time for this. He's an associate professor of political science and coordinator of the Nuclear Proliferation Prevention Project at UT, but he don't know about nukes. I asked him. Oh, well, I sent him two emails, and the second one I clarified, could you check this paragraph for me? Which is the one about how much uranium they would need to make one nuke. Jeez, how much? I'm wasting too much time. Let me just go through this. I'll try to debunk as fast as I can as I go through. According to him, they would still, under the deal, they would still be at a few months, not a year, from a bomb if they were to sneak out and try to build it. It would still, of course, give the Americans plenty of time to start a war against them, assuming that premise. That would be perfectly okay. But anyway, he says breakout time is determined by the number and type of centrifuges, the enrichment of the starting material, and the amount of enriched uranium required for a nuclear bomb. Obama seems to make rosy assumptions about all three. Obama's argument assumes Iran would only employ the 5,000-something centrifuges that the deal would allow for uranium enrichment, not the roughly 14,000 additional centrifuges that Iran would be permitted to keep mainly for spare parts. Such an assumption is laughable. In a real-world breakout, Iran would race, not crawl, to the bomb. Then he concedes these additional centrifuges would need to be connected, brought up to speed, and calibrated with the already operating ones. But at that point, Iran's enrichment capacity could exceed three times what Obama assumes. What he's admitting here is none of this could happen in secret. They would have to basically come out, the Ayatollah come out and beat his chest and say, yeah, we're going to make nukes now. What are you going to do about it? West is the only way that this could happen in outright and total violation of their safeguards agreement. Then he says, oh, Obama's assuming, well, they'd only have this small amount of enriched in uranium hexafluoride gas, but they would still have some metal in solid form, and that could be reconverted to gas within weeks, and then that gas could be reintroduced and further enriched, again, which could not possibly take place in secret. They're going to even retool the Isfahan facility in order, Isfahan or whatever, facility in order to turn the metal back into gas. When right now it does that with the not refined and enriched uranium, low enriched uranium, but with yellow cake. They'd have to change that whole facility, go through all of this, turn in what metal stock they do have, they already have other uses for, back into gas. Again, oh, but just in a matter of weeks. Why? I don't know. Maybe. Maybe it's true. Maybe just because he says so. And then he says, and this is what I was trying to ask Gordon, I'll try to get better information for you about the actual weight here. But he says, Obama assumes that they would need 59 pounds of weapons-grade uranium to make an atomic bomb. But then he says, man, I'm already out of time. I wasted too much time. Sorry. He basically conflates a simple gun-type nuke, which would be huge, with a super sophisticated, miniaturized implosion bomb, which would almost certainly have to be made up out of plutonium, not uranium, as he falsely says North Korea's nukes are made out of. Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop, which is, by the way, what he's doing right now, selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com. You hate government? One of them libertarian types? Or maybe you just can't stand the president, gun grabbers, or warmongers. Me too. That's why I invented LibertyStickers.com. Well, Rick owns it now, and I didn't make up all of them, but still, if you're driving around and want to tell everyone else how wrong their politics are, there's only one place to go. LibertyStickers.com has got your bumper covered. Left, right, libertarian, empire, police state, founders quote, central banking. Yes, bumper stickers about central banking. Lots of them. And, well, everything that matters. LibertyStickers.com. Everyone else's stickers suck. All right, you guys, welcome back. It's okay that I ran out of time for that segment. I was pretty much done debunking it. I debunked the end at the beginning, so. You can debunk it yourself. It's in the New York Times today by Cooperman. Go look at it. It's pretty ridiculous. Just squint, and you'll see. First guest today is Jerome Slater. And, oh, I got his bio at the bottom of the page here. He is a professor emeritus of political science and now a university research scholar at the State University of New York at Buffalo. And he's got his own website at jeromeslater.com. And here he is at Mondo Weiss. And this one is called Obfuscating the Truth, the UN Report on War Crimes in Operation Protective Edge. Welcome to the show. How are you doing, Jerome?
Good, thank you.
Good. Very happy to have you on the show, and appreciate your analysis of the UN report. I guess it just came out yesterday, correct?
Yes.
And this was the UN commission appointed to investigate Operation Protective Edge. And, I don't know. I guess I'll let you take it from there. What was the most important thing about it, do you think?
Well, going to be different opinions. In fact, there already are different opinions about what the most important thing it is. On the one hand, it confirms, really, and adds more detail to reports from journalist reports and reports of various human rights organizations, Amnesty International, Human Rights Watch.
I'm sorry, Jerome. I'm sorry to interrupt you, but we got a problem with your phone. Could you maybe jiggle the cord a little bit? I think maybe that's the problem. That's a bit better, actually.
Okay. Yeah, I think there probably is something wrong with the cord. Okay. Can you hear me now?
Yeah, not so good. I guess let's try to go on for a little while and see what happens.
Okay. You can also call me on my cell phone. Well, all right. Never mind.
Yeah. You know what? Yeah, let's do that. If you could email me back that cell phone number, I'll call you right back.
Okay.
Okay.
Bye.
Thanks. Yeah. Hey, no problem, everybody. It's live radio. These things happen. And, you know, better to go ahead and get the audio right. Don't you think? All right. Let me find some audio to play for you here. Oh, yeah, this is good.
If we have to choose the lesser of evils here, the lesser evil is the Sunnis over the Shiites. It's an evil, believe me, it's a terrible evil. Again, they've just taken out 1,700 former Iraqi soldiers and shot them in a field. But who are they fighting against? They're fighting against the proxy with Iran that's complicit in the murder of 160,000 people in Syria. You can just, you know, do the math. And again, one side is armed with suicide bombers and rockets. The other side has access to military nuclear capabilities. So from Israel's perspective, if there's got to be an evil that's going to prevail, you know, let the Sunni evil prevail.
Our allies in the region were our largest problem in Syria. The Turks were great friends, the Saudis, the Emiratis, etc. They were so determined to take down Assad, they poured hundreds of millions of dollars and tens, thousands of tons of weapons into anyone who would fight against Assad. Except that the people who were being supplied were al-Nusra and al-Qaeda.
All right, guys. Technical difficulty, no problem. These things happen on a live radio show from time to time, no big deal. It's, again, Jerome Slater wrote this piece for MondoWeiss.net, Obfuscating the Truth, the UN Report on War Crimes in Operation Protective Edge. And I'm sorry I asked you such a general question to get us started off here about, you know, what you thought was the most important thing in there. But so I think you were saying, I don't know. Go ahead, I guess. I already got you started.
Right. I suppose the most important thing is the adding of detail on the various war crimes, although the commission fudges a bit and calls them maybe war crimes, but it's clearly they consider them to be war crimes committed by both Israel and Hamas. And they have the report contains great detail on a number of specific incidents and cases. That's the most important. It's also controversial because it attempts to be very balanced, and I'm going to put balanced in quotes, in juxtaposing the actions of Hamas with those of Israel, when it is clear that Israel's attacks on civilians were far more extensive than were those of Hamas.
Yeah, now that's interesting. Of course, you know, the way they have to, I guess, try to spin it that, well, look, we're looking at both sides, and then the language for both sides ends up pretty much the same. And it's true that Hamas rockets killed at least one Israeli child, I know, and they are, you know, kind of firing blind over the wall. But is the UN basically saying that to fire such a primitive, unguidable rocket toward where there could be civilians amounts to an attack on civilians, a war crime, just because they don't have laser-guided drone Hellfire missiles to target IDF headquarters with, or that kind of thing?
Well, yes, because they even hedge on that, because they say in a number of places that they're really not quite sure that Hamas was attacking civilians, although it did hit some civilians, that it might have also been attacking Israeli military targets, which were very close to the civilians that were hit. So they're even providing a kind of, I don't know if excuse is the right word, but an explanation for Hamas's attack on civilians, which may have been only a consequence of their not having accurate enough weapons or maybe accurate enough intelligence to hit military targets, which they may have been aiming for. So they're using a lot of qualified language.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it does make sense, and I'm not testifying to any fact here or anything, but it sounds plausible enough to me that Hamas would have their own version of a price tag that, hey, you know what? All we have is these rockets. We are going to shoot them toward, we think, they're where there might be civilian apartment buildings and try to terrorize the population, turn them against the government policy. That's a tactic in war. And Hamas will send, in the past, they'll send a suicide bomber to a pizzeria. So why the hell wouldn't they do that? I mean, they're Hamas, for Christ's sake.
Yeah, no, exactly. In fact, they even, spokesmen several times have admitted that they're going to respond in turn to what Israel does, which is to attack civilian targets. So, yes, I mean, as you say, they have a history of attacking civilian targets anyway.
Yeah.
But I'm going to add that there are two differences between what Hamas did and what Israel did. First of all, the Hamas attacks were far less extensive, if only because they didn't have the weapons. I think the estimate of the general estimate is that something like 1,400 civilians were killed by the Israeli attack in Gaza, and something like 7 or 8 were killed in the Hamas attack on Israeli civilians, or numbers of that order. Because the other thing is that Israel is occupying Palestinian territories, and it has quite a repressive occupation. In addition to occupying it, it occupies it repressively and often violently. So Hamas can be seen, they certainly see it that way themselves, as trying to liberate the Palestinian territories, principally Gaza in their case, but also the West Bank. Mm-hmm. From the Israeli occupation.
Right.
What the Israelis are trying to do is to maintain the occupation. There's really no doubt about that.
Right. All right, I'm sorry. We got to take this break, Jerome. We'll be right back on the other side of this break with Jerome Slater writing at MondoWeiss.net today about the new UN report on Operation Protective Edge, so-called. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Robertson Roberts Brokerage Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Robertson Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. Hey, I'll Scott Horton here for Liberty.me, the social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features classes, discussions, guides, events, publishing, podcasts, and so much more. And Jeffrey Tucker and I are starting a new monthly show at Liberty.me, Eye on the Empire. It's just $4 a month if you use promo code Scott when you sign up. And hey, once you do, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me. All right, guys, welcome back. We were interrupted by the break, but before that, we were talking with Jerome Slater, right in here at Mondo Weiss, obfuscating the truth, the UN report on war crimes in Operation Protective Edge. And we're talking about the false equivalence of Hamas. Now, maybe the moral equivalence is the same, but in terms of who's occupying who and who's arming who, you know, there is no comparison. I mean, this is basically like Dick Cheney on a canned hunt of a wild animal who can't get outside the chain link fence. It's Israel's fence. We even saw just anecdotally the other day, the Israelis acquitted themselves of bombing the boys on the beach to death just to kind of put an exclamation point behind the fact that they are completely penned in. They don't even control their own coast, the people of the Gaza Strip. On TV news in America, they act like Gaza or Palestine in general, same for the West Bank, is the country next door rather than basically an Israeli-run prison by the sea where every once in a while they bomb their trustees, which seems like a much more apt way to describe the situation where Hamas, for whatever reason, isn't doing exactly what they want. And so they bomb the people of Gaza in the name of bombing Hamas. That sound about right?
Just about, yep.
And now, so does this report talk about how this thing started and what led to the beginning of the war?
A good question, and my frank answer is I don't remember off the top of my head how much they went into. They did go a little bit into the context. Yes, they did a little bit, but that wasn't the main purpose of the report.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you talk about in here,
the answer is yes.
Yeah, well, I mean, you talk about it here that they accept the premise that this was defense, so maybe they didn't do a very good job of bombing in defense, but they were defending themselves, which is actually contrary to the real truth of how the war started, of course, where Israel was bombing the Gaza Strip in the name of the three kidnapped guys who the Israeli government already knew for 2 weeks had already been killed while they were pretending to search for them and targeting every member of Hamas on the West Bank. They also started bombing them on the Gaza Strip, I believe it was on the 6th, and then the first rocket attack in response came on the 7th, if I got my dates right.
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think you also have to emphasize, as I did earlier, the larger context. And the larger context is that Israel has occupied the Palestinian territory since 1967 and has sought to repress all forms of resistance, not just terrorism, by the way, but also nonviolent resistance is repressed by Israel, often violently. And so when you engage in that kind of behavior, there's going to be resistance. And it's, of course, very unfortunate, to say the least, when that resistance takes the form of terrorism. But one also has to remember that Israeli terrorism has been far more extensive than Hamas terrorism. That is to say, where terrorism is defined, as it commonly is, as intentionally attacking non-combatants or civilian targets. And those targets are not limited to civilians or people as such, but also to their economy, their social structure, and so on. And Israel has been doing that for many years, and that naturally engenders resistance.
Well, and how much of a game changer do you think it is now that the Prime Minister Netanyahu has said there's never going to be a two-state solution. All the land from the river to the sea belongs to me. Now that the pretense is over, does that really change anything? Or they'll just continue with their facts on the ground?
Yeah, no, it doesn't change anything much. I mean, it gets out into the open what everybody who's been paying any attention at all has known for years, that Israel has no intention of giving up, or at least Israel, when it's led by the right wing, as it is now, has no intention of withdrawing. But other than that, I don't think anything much is going to change. The widely accepted assessment, and one that I hold, is that it's unrealistic in the extreme to expect change from Israel, coming from within Israel, change from Israeli policies, which is generated from Israel itself. It's going to take a lot of outside pressure. The state that has the most capabilities for such pressure is obviously the United States. But the only thing that would work would be making American economic and military and political support of Israel conditional upon them agreeing to a negotiated and fair two-state settlement. But the United States is not about to put that kind of pressure on Israel. No political party has any incentive to do so. The downside politically is far greater than what you might gain. And so it's not going to happen. Frankly, I'm very pessimistic. I don't see any solution to this, at least not in the foreseeable future.
Yeah. Well, and you sure do get it right there about the politics, not necessarily what's good for the national interest of the country and the 300 million of us, but the squeaky wheel gets the grease up there, and the squeaky wheel is the Israeli government and their lobby. And that's what really counts on this issue. There is no real organized opposition to them.
Well, it's not only the lobby. That puts it, I think, a little bit too narrowly. If by lobby you mean, you know, specific interest groups, it's also that the American people as a whole, poll after poll, year after year, shows that they are far more critical of the Palestinians than of the Israel, and so there isn't any political gain to be made by taking on Israeli policies.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, and that's just because on TV they never really explain who's occupying who. Again, they always kind of refer to the Palestinians as neighbors without really defining what they mean. Even in the midst of talking about a someday two-state solution, they still never say, like you said, well, you see, they've been occupied since 1967. Those words never come out of the mouth of a TV news anchor ever, not in 30 years has anybody ever talked like that on there, except maybe Pat Buchanan once on MSNBC. But other than that,
right. That's
just Americans just don't know. They don't show them a map. They just don't tell them the truth.
Yeah, and it's not a matter of opinion that there's been an occupation since 67. It's a brute fact. So you would think that this would be at least sometimes mentioned, if not emphasized, as an explanation for why you have Palestinian terrorism or any other form of resistance.
Yeah. Yep. Nope. They'll just never give that context. And I think it's because it's a safe bet that the American people like to believe, at least, that we side with the underdog and the little guy and the occupied against the dictatorship. And so who wants to be under the martial law of a foreign government for 50 years? That doesn't sound fair. We might side with the Palestinians if we knew what was going on there, I think. In fact, the truth of the Gaza Strip is just like the narrative about Israel, surrounded by enemies, helpless and desperate to not get pushed into the sea and constantly under siege and all this. It's not really true about Israel. They're surrounded by weak and friendly neighbors mostly. It's the people of Gaza who are living that narrative.
Let me just modify what you just said, or at least state my opinion. A significant degree of truth that in the early years of the conflict, it was surrounded by powerful Arab states, which posed a threat to the independence and maybe even the existence of Israel. But that hasn't been true, or it's becoming less and less true as Israel becomes more and more powerful, as more and more of the Arab states have individually reached a peace agreement with Israel, like Egypt and Jordan. or when the Arab League as a whole has unanimously said they will support a two-state settlement. So Israel is far more powerful than its neighbors, many of whom are falling apart, as we know. And the Arab states as a whole and individually have repeatedly said we want to reach an agreement that's fair to the Palestinians. And what's fair to the Palestinians is defined to mean a separate, independent Palestinian state, not the destruction of Israel itself.
Right. And, well, I guess we're almost out of time. I guess we could mention that Hamas has even agreed to recognize Israel if they would live to their end, live up to their end of the ceasefire and lift the siege. And the PLO and PLA, whatever, has offered to recognize, or I guess has recognized Israel even since 1988, right?
Right. Yeah, I'm not sure that Hamas has officially said that it will officially recognize Israel, but they've sent all kinds of signals for many years that at least de facto they are ready to agree to a two-state solution.
Well, I saw one of their ministers say on Charlie Rose one time that, yeah, we would recognize within 67 borders. Let's shake hands.
Yeah, maybe so. Yeah. You may be right.
And now I'm not saying they're going to necessarily live by what they said on Charlie Rose or whatever, but that was why they started moving the goalposts and saying, yeah, but you have to say it's a Jewish state and all this kind of, you know, altering the deal and pray I don't alter it any further kind of thing. I'm sorry, I'm keeping you over just a minute here, Jerome, but if I could ask you about this one part of the report that you highlight here in the article about what may amount to war crimes, where the Israelis they're doing things, as the UN characterizes it, that are resulting in large amounts of civilians being killed, and then they keep doing those things, and so perhaps this evinces a design to do these things on purpose. Is that about as close as they get to saying that the Israeli government was deliberately targeting civilians in the actual?
Well, they have this. It's obvious that they deliberately targeted the civilian infrastructure of Gaza. There isn't any question about that. And obviously the people who wrote this report know that, too. But they don't want, for political reasons or lack of courage, frankly, to state that this not only is the policy of the Israeli government, it has been the policy of the Israeli government in the past. So they dance around with all kinds of indirect language saying that it suggests the possibility that this may have had the tacit encouragement of the Israeli government. That's just plain nonsense, and I think that they know it's nonsense. You know, as you sort of suggested yourself earlier, no one wants to state but official bodies don't want to state the unvarnished truth about what has been going on. So they feel the need to provide balance, even if the imbalance is far greater than any balance, and they don't really want to come out and say it's the policy of the Israeli government, it's the Israeli way of war in the past to punish civilians in the hope that it will deter resistance to their own policies. I won't answer that.
All right. Yeah, I'll let you go with that. Thank you very much for your time. I really appreciate talking with you today.
Thank you.
All right, y'all. That is Jerome Slater. He writes at jeromeslater.com. Here he is at mondoweiss.net with this piece, Obfuscating the Truth, the UN Report on War Crimes in Operation Protective Edge. And he is a research scholar now at the State University of New York at Buffalo. And we'll be right back. Hey, y'all, guess what? You can now order transcripts of any interview I've done for the incredibly reasonable price of $2.50 each. Listen, finding a good transcriptionist is near impossible, but I've got one now. Just go to scotthorton.org/transcripts, enter the name and date of the interview you want written up, click the PayPal button, and I'll have it in your email in 72 hours max. You don't need a PayPal account to do this. Man, I'm really going to have to learn how to talk more good. That's scotthorton.org/transcripts.
Don't you get sick of the Israel lobby trying to get us into more wars in the Middle East? Or always abusing Palestinians with your tax dollars? It once seemed like the lobby would always have full-spectrum dominance on the foreign policy discussion in D.C. But those days are over. The Council for the National Interest is the America Lobby, standing up and pushing back against the Israel Lobby's undue influence on Capitol Hill. Go show some support at councilforthenationalinterest.org. That's councilforthenationalinterest.org.
Okay, guys, it's summer fun drive time at the Scott Horton Show. Bills are piling up and equipment is wearing out. So here's the deal. Anyone who donates $50 or more gets a chance to win a week's vacation for two to Costa Rica. Drawing is July 15th. Winner, go whenever you want. See more details at scotthorton.org/raffle. Anyone who donates $100 or more gets entered into the raffle, plus a 1-ounce silver QR code commodity disc from commoditydiscs.com. And the first 25 people to donate $100 or more will also get a copy of Your Money or Your Life, Why We Must Abolish the Income Tax by Sheldon Richman, or the audiobook of Lou Rockwell's Fascism versus Capitalism, narrated by me, for free. Stop by scotthorton.org/donate or scotthorton.org/raffle for details. You can also sign up for monthly donations by way of PayPal, per interview at Patreon, support with Bitcoin, and shop through scotthorton.org/Amazon. And thanks.
All right, cool. I'm Scott. It's my show. Coming up, Gareth Porter with more on Iran. Sorry about your ear there. What does he got here, man? Oh no. Yeah, I should have emailed that guy. I'll put that off. I got Ukraine. I got, what's, oh, this one, the Iraq thing. Ah, jeez. First of all, go to my website, scotthorton.org, and look in the right-hand margin, way down at the bottom now. You'll see an ad for Fascism versus Capitalism. It's the brand new audiobook narrated by me of Lou Rockwell's book, Fascism versus Capitalism. Go and buy it and listen to it. Okay, cool. Also, enter the raffle. You'll win a trip to Costa Rica. Where's that article now? Oh, here it is. Concerns as Pentagon chief broaches possibility of, quote, three Iraqs, not one. Analysts warn comments may demoralize Baghdad. Oh, what a stupid world. Ooh, ooh, yeah. There hadn't been such a thing as Iraq since 2007. I don't know. That's slightly overstated, but not really. Take a walk with me back in time, say 2 years ago. We're at 1 year out from the caliphate, right? But 2 years ago, Patrick Coburn wrote in The Independent, and he came on this show to elaborate the story of Shiite Iraqi army troops, the entire Iraqi army virtually is Shiites, who had been stationed up in Mosul, said, forget this, man. They were way out at Fort Apache out there, or Fort something or other, and they felt like they didn't have enough support from back in Baghdad. As Coburn described it, the Iraqi army is a ghost army. Most of it is all just budget padding corruption in the worst way. This is a George W. Bush, Dick Cheney joint, man. What did you think? All the incentives are baked in all wrong. It's a government program. And so those guys said, you know what, forget this, and they went home. They were ceding Mosul to the locals. And they left. And then about 6 months after that, they hoisted up the black flag over Fallujah. And now, at the time, I guess I kind of screwed that one up a little bit, because what happened was the tribal leaders told them to take it down. And I oversimplified my analysis of that. I guess I remember reading over at Pat Lang's blog, he had some guy saying, look, it's the tribal leaders who have declared independence from Baghdad here and have told their army to take a hike. And there wasn't really, I don't think, much of a big battle. They just withdrew. But the tribal leaders had then told the Islamic State guys, take your flag down. And I guess I saw that as too much of a sign of weakness, because I was just too used to Al-Qaeda in Iraq being a smaller and much weaker faction of Sunni fighters compared to the tribal chiefs back in history. Just in terms of relative power. And I knew that the Islamic State was stronger than Al-Qaeda in Iraq, but I didn't realize how much stronger, I guess, until the way that they went into Mosul a year ago. But it's been the case that the entire policy, and you know what? We're going on now literally 10 years, 11, 12 years, but certainly 11 years, if not 12, of talking about on this show the fact that America picked, and I was kind of behind the curve because, I don't know, when I first interviewed Bob Dreyfus, man, that could have been 2004. Yeah, 11 years. 2003, maybe. Nah, I don't know. I gotta check the archives for 2003 now that I'm wondering about it. Anyway, it's been very clear. You could have read it in Raimondo at antiwar.com too, that Bush picked, among all the Shiite factions, the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq. Abdulaziz al-Hakim was the guy, and his family and faction. Well, they were the Iraqi traitors who had fled to Iran when Jimmy Carter hired Saddam Hussein to invade Iran in 1980. They had fled to Iran, and they were working for the Ayatollah ever since then. And when Bush invaded, they came in working for the Ayatollahs. And those are the guys that Bush chose. Now, Muqtada al-Sadr was a Shiite leader, and he wanted to hold Iraq together. Iraqi nationalism, Arab nationalism. He was a religious guy. He's a, you know, not the highest ranking kind of mullah Ayatollah or whatever, but he's a Shiite religious authority. And he was saying, we're all Iraqis, we're all Arabs and Kurds too, and let's all just, you know, oppose America and Iran together. So America chose Iran and marginalized Sadr, and then pretended, of course, used as their excuse the idea that he was the most Iranian-backed of all the Shiite factions, when he was the Iraqi nationalist trying to limit Iran and America and make a deal with the Iraqi Sunni. But the Americans chose the Supreme Council for Islamic Revolution in Iraq and the Dawah Party, and those were the guys who worked for Iran, who they knew better than to want to rule Fallujah, Ramadi, and Mosul. Why, and to Crete for that matter, why try to rule Sunnistan? Let them go. They got all the oil. I mean, and the Kurds have their own up near Kirkuk, but the Shiites have plenty of their own oil down near, Basra and down near Kuwait. And the Americans helped them take Baghdad and kick all the Sunnis out of Baghdad and make it a 90% Shiite city or something along those lines. And so that was it. If America won the Iraq War, if the surge worked in any sense, the surge worked for Iran's auxiliary, the Badr Brigade, and their political faction, their Sinn Féin, Skiri, or Iski. They later changed it because they won. So they were no longer for revolution, they won the revolution. So then they became the Iraqi Supreme Islamic Council, or the Islamic Supreme Council of Iraq, Iski, that was what it was. Islamic Supreme Council. All right. So, if the surge worked at all, it worked at giving them Baghdad and breaking Iraq into three, at least into two, and then the splits between the Shiites and the Kurds. They can either work them out or they can use them as excuses to break apart either way. But Kurdistan has been autonomous since 1991, since the first Gulf War, when America created the no-fly zone. And America and Britain, and the no-drive zone up there, and basically guaranteed their autonomy from Saddam Hussein that entire time through the entire 1990s before the War of 03. And so, it's been a ridiculous lie this whole time that they've been saying, oh yeah, our policy is we're going to work with the Iraqi Shiite political factions. We're another Dawah Party guy. After Jafari, Maliki, and after Maliki, Abadi, they're all Dawah Party guys. They all want the same thing, which is whatever the Ayatollah Khomeini wants. And, but we're going to prevail upon him to just be nice and work with the Sunnis and bring them back under the control of Baghdad, which is never going to happen under the Islamic State or anybody else. So they're lying a little less about what they're doing now, I guess? I don't know. Phone records, financial and location data, Prism, Tempora, X-Keyscore, Boundless Informant.
Hey, y'all, Scott Horton here for offnow.org. Now, here's the deal. Due to the Snowden revelations, we have a great opportunity for a short period of time to get some real rollback of the national surveillance state. Now, they're already trying to tire us by introducing fake reforms in the Congress. And the courts, they betrayed their sworn oaths to the Constitution and Bill of Rights again and again, and can in no way be trusted to stop the abuses for us. We've got to do it ourselves. How? We nullify it at the state level. It's still not easy, but the OffNow project of the 10th Amendment Center has gotten off to a great start. I mean it. There's real reason to be optimistic here. They've gotten their model legislation introduced all over the place, in state after state. I've lost count, more than a dozen. You're always wondering, yeah, but what can we do? Here's something. Something important. Something that can work if we do the work. Get started cutting off the NSA support in your state. Go to offnow.org. All right, you guys, welcome back. So, here's the thing. Tons to talk about and not much time because our good friend Gareth is coming on in just a minute to tell us the what for. So, dozens killed in attack on the Islamic State in Libya. I guess civil war and chaos is just going to reign there for a while, man. Doesn't look like anybody is close to claiming a monopoly on force and ending the war. And it doesn't look like the separate factions are anything like happy to let things stay where they are and just quit fighting, split the country up wherever they are or anything like that. So I guess the war is just going to rage on. You know, it's the same wrongness of my bet with Gareth, where I just said, man, where the Americans create chaos like this, they're going to occupy the place and they're going to do purple-fingered elections and they're just going to stay forever. That's what's going to happen in Libya. It's so obvious that in overthrowing Gaddafi, they're going to overthrow his entire state. And then what? There'll be a civil war over the massive power vacuum. It's going to be a disaster. So, in other words, then there will be tens of thousands of American troops to train up a new army and hold purple-fingered elections and create a democracy and all this. Because what are you just going to do? Turn the entire middle part of North Africa into a jihadist wonderland? And then not use it as an excuse to invade, huh? And that's what they've done so far. Yeah, they bomb over there occasionally, but they did the other day claim they got their bad guy who they failed to get. And they're just letting it simmer. I mean, thank God, right? I've never been more happy to be wrong. Well, I don't know if that's true, but that I can think of right now, I'm very happy that I was wrong about that. I just couldn't imagine that we're going to go, you know, more than a few suicide truck bombings before the Americans come in with full force. What's Obama going to do? Just pull his guys out? Not use, let a crisis go to waste. And so, I don't know. I guess they just like having more and more Mujahideen so they can guarantee a further generation of fighters to ship off to Syria wherever they still have unfinished business. Is that it? Or maybe, thank God, they're just scared of doing what George W. Bush did and having that same kind of level of failure. Hey, Obama's already way in lame duck territory. Might as well let it be Hillary's problem. It is hers anyway, right? Let Jeb and Richard Pearl figure out what to do. They know what to do. Get me the hell out of here, he's saying. And again, boy, I don't want anybody to misunderstand me like I'm saying I support any intervention there or ever did. So I certainly don't. Well, no, that's not true. I did support Ronald Reagan's attack in 1984, even though my parents were against it. I was for it because fighter planes. Whatever an F-111 is, cool. And wherever Libya is, hey, it's far enough away that if the president, who the teachers at school say is legit, says it's okay to bomb them, it's all right. I'll buy that. What the hell do I care? I just like fighter planes. That was when I first learned how to doodle a fighter plane on the back of my homework. Cool, an F-111 bomb dropper plane. Okay, so I supported that. But I was in fourth grade, and so that's my pass. But no, none of this recent stuff, though. Definitely not.
But I'm just saying, isn't it a damn miracle how wrong I was and how little further intervention there's been there? They station their ambassador in the middle of a hornet's nest. The hornets sting them, and then that's it. They pull out. They leave. It's over. Apparently, DIA reports, Seymour Hersh reports. Hey, after Benghazi, that was the end of that. So, man, I'm glad I was wrong about that. And Gareth Porter has a new one. We're going to talk with him about it, Iran, but also about Iraq, where, as I was explaining to you guys yesterday, he had this piece based on that Washington Post story where the generals are the doves. The State Department, John Kerry's guys, wanted to send in Apaches and more fighters, and the DOD vetoed it. And so we don't want to go. We're just going to get guys killed, and we're going to not accomplish anything. Imagine that. An excuse for the Pentagon to go back to Iraq, and they don't want to go. I even have the clip here. Well, I mean, they're already there some. I'm not trying to deny they're already there some. And it could escalate. Again, kicking the can down the road, Mr. Lame Duck President, let Jeb escalate, get me the hell out of here kind of thing. Maybe that's his game. But according to Gareth, the Army is like, no, man, we don't want to do this. We already did it. This is what we got, and we don't want to do it again. So, man, can you imagine that? Is that really true? I guess as long as the Air Force can drop bombs, then it's still fun for them in that fourth grade kind of way. Well, I don't know. That's too bad. All right. So anyway, thank God I was wrong about Libya, and I was, I guess, mostly wrong about Iraq, at least so far, which means I owe Garrett $10. I really thought I had won the bet, and the bet was by New Year's, but we're still only dealing in low thousands, very low thousands. That's not really an invasion. And the advisors could become an invasion. Again, I ain't excusing it or anything. I'm just talking about for the sake of my bet with Gareth. My bet with Gareth was they're going to send in numbers of men to invade. They have to, but no, I was wrong, at least so far. Huh. Really, it's kind of puzzling to me. Anyway, here's what I'm not doing a good enough job covering, and that's Ukraine. McCain slams European stance on Ukraine. They want less confrontation. They want less training and weapons. But NATO leaders, you know, NATO isn't just a treaty organization. It's its own bureaucracy, too. They have their own goals. Sometimes, anyway. Certainly, they're all individuals seeking their own fame and fortune in their way. NATO leaders seek 40,000 troops along Russian border. U.S. pledges troops and equipment to latest escalation. Right at the time that right sector, the Nazis, America's Nazis in Ukraine, think of them as Dylan Roof, only heroic because they work for the Democrats. They demand an end to the ceasefire. They want to go back to war. And they have been fighting anyway. And America's been training them. Really. And by the way, there's this great article by Paul something. It's not Paul Pilar. Maybe it's not Paul anything. Phil's group, the Council for the National Interest. It's just the National Interest. The National Interest Foundation and the National Interest, the website. And they have this article by this guy talking about, I don't have it in front of me, but it's about what a bad idea it is to do all these new transfers of weapons to Eastern Europe. I really think you should take a look at it, because the guy, you can tell he's a national security professional type. He makes a very succinct argument into just how little this is. It's just enough to be a threat and not enough to do any good. So maybe fall into enemy hands, provoke a confrontation with the Russians that could get us all killed. Really? Could get us all killed? Wouldn't that be the irony? Quarter century after the fall of communism. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future Freedom Foundation at fff.org/subscribe.
Since 1989, FFF has been pushing an uncompromising moral and economic case for peace, individual liberty, and free markets. Sign up now for The Future Freedom, featuring founder and president Jacob Hornberger, as well as Sheldon Richmond, James Bovard, Anthony Gregory, Wendy McElroy, and many more. It's just $25 a year for the print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's fff.org/subscribe. And tell them Scott sent you.
All right, guys, welcome back. Hey, check it out. I got Gareth Porter on the line. Hey, Gareth, how are you doing? Check, check. Can you hear me?
Not good.
Hey, Gareth. Uh-oh. I can hear you, but I think you can't hear me. That could be a problematic
Scott?
Problem.
Oh?
Oh, I heard you a little bit there. Can you hear me? Uh-oh. Yeah. Better call him on his cell phone, dude. All right, well, good. That gives me an opportunity to play this. Oh, man, I don't know what's going on now with this thing. All right. Yeah, well, you're welcome for the dead air. I'm blaming it on the Flash player. It is the ruiner of everything good in the whole world. And I wish ill will and bad events on all who are associated in any way with the Flash project over there at Adobe. Can't even play a soundbite to entertain you while I'm trying to get Gareth on the phone, because that damn thing ruined my computer's audio output. You know what? Oh, well, whatever. Hang on. It's really Gareth's fault for not having a speaker set. Let's see if he answers his cell phone here. This is a show. It's live radio. It happens. Hey, you set? Hang on. All right, so we got Gareth on the line here, man. Like I was promising before, but now where you can hear him too. Hey, how are you doing, Gareth?
I'm fine. Apparently we couldn't get the Skype connection.
Yeah, I think I could hear you a little bit, but I think you couldn't hear me. But that's all right. Don't worry about
okay,
it.
Okay, yeah.
Yeah, these things happen. I hate Skype so much. You know, the audio quality is so much better, and yet the technical difficulties that come with it are ridiculous. But The point being is that you wrote some things, and so I want to talk with you about them, of course, because I always want to talk with you about the things you write, because things you write are always right on topic for what's most important to me, and yeah, along the lines of telling the truth about what they're lying about, they being the war party. Obviously. And so, first of all, I really do owe you $10. And someone was joking around. Actually, somebody paid me your $10 and said, here's Gareth's $10 that he owes you for that bet, because Obama sent another couple of hundred guys. But you wrote this piece and you persuaded me. It's based on this Washington Post story that, no, really, they're not coming. As Mitchell Prothero put it from Irrible, the Americans are not coming. And when they told you they're not coming, really, they're not coming. So you better go ahead and do your own thing, whatever. You say in your article that the leaders of the Army and the Marine Corps and the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff and all those guys are adamantly opposed to invading and taking Islamic State territory.
That's correct. I mean, that's clearly the military leadership's position on this. It seems to be pretty deeply embedded in their view of the conflict in the Middle East now, that the fight against Islamic State is not the American fight. It's something that the Arabs should take care of. The U.S. can't do it. I think that's fair to say, or shouldn't do it. And you know, as I say in my article, the one that you just cited, I think the key to that position is really the knowledge that has come from a combination of Iraq and Afghanistan, that they're going to get in deeper than they want to be if they start having boots on the ground against Islamic State, that that they cannot foresee the full consequences that would occur from starting that kind of war on the ground, and they're a bit intimidated by it. Quite frankly, I think that's the bottom line.
Awesome. Well, that's great, but I guess, so here's the part that, well, there's two things that I was wrong about, really. One is what you just described, the military's willingness to commit to this. I know that you'll remember, you reported it, and I still have the clip here somewhere of Jim Michaleski on NBC News, right as Obama's being inaugurated, telling NBC that, hey, I'm here at the Pentagon, and the generals say they don't care what the president says. They're going to stay in Iraq for at least 20 more years. And they stole it fair and square, right, and they're keeping it. And I just assume that, yeah, that's speaking for the Pentagon right there. And if they had a way back into Iraq, especially in a full-scale kind of a way, give me my 56 bases or else kind of a thing, that they'd be happy to take that. And so I was wrong about that, but I was also wrong, I guess very wrong about that, but I was also wrong about the political pressure. Because here we have not Saddam Hussein with the clean-shaven chin and the beret. What is he, French, with his little beret and his olive green, you know, when he's not wearing, you know, an American-style suit with lapels. It's not him. It's the caliph. It's Ibrahim, who's basically Osama himself up there. And they're going to let that slide. And I just thought politically that, man, they'll drop an atom bomb on Mosul before they just let there really be a caliphate and let that go. Not that I'm promoting that, but I'm just saying it seemed to me that Washington, D.C. would have one consensus, which is bomb Mosul.
Yes, yes. Well, I mean, I think what you were responding to in assuming that was the case was this kind of hysteria that did develop, obviously, through the news media. And you know, Republican commenters within and outside Congress both on, you know, blaming the Obama administration for not being more muscular in its response. So, you know, what we're starting with here is this dynamic that has long existed in American domestic politics of, you know, the Out Party in particular using the lack of you know, use of force by the president as a whip to attack them politically, to try to take advantage of it. And you know, that was clearly very much the dynamic that was at work last year when the war against the Islamic State began with the bombing. And I think that you know, there's a big distinction here, and that this has become clearer, obviously, a big distinction between that dynamic on one hand and the interests of the military services and the Pentagon on the other. Because, as I point out in my article, what the service chiefs, the military leadership, and I think it's true as well of the civilian leadership in the Pentagon, the Secretary of Defense and his staff, what they're doing is calculating very carefully, in some cases carefully, in other cases perhaps less carefully, the profit and loss, the gains and risks of committing U.S. forces. And I think it's the calculus is more complex, has more moving parts to it or more possible elements to it than people generally realize.
Yeah. Well, and, you know, I don't know how much of this really plays into it. I wonder what you think of my old joke, now a year old, that it's really because of, oh, is the music already playing? Eh, these things happen. Well, on the other side of the break, I'm going to ask you about it, how much of this you think has to do with the fact that because of Israel and, I guess, to a lesser extent, Saudi politics in the capital, that we can't really go to war against the Mujahideen because that's who our allies want to win over there. But hold it right there. We'll be right back in just a sec. Hey, Al Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and you get free shipping. darrenscoffee.com. All right, guys, welcome back. I'm Scott. I'm talking with Gareth Porter. He wrote the book Manufactured Crisis on the Iranian Nuclear Program, which we're going to get to those talks here in just a sec. We're talking about the lack of a full-scale war against the Islamic State. Thank goodness, because the Pentagon agrees with us on this. Don't do it. I mean,
yes, they have advisors, and they're bombing the hell out of them from the air all the time. I guess not on Vietnam, you know, carpet bombing type levels, but still. So it's not like they're non-interventionists now or anything necessarily. But it does seem, Gareth, like if, and never mind morality or libertarianism or non-intervention or anything like that, but just the empire's prerogatives, it seems like what they might do would be to make a deal with Iran and Assad that will give you money and a little bit of AWACS support or whatever you need to crush these guys for us. Because they are the obvious most natural enemies of the Islamic State, and go ahead and throw in the al-Nusra Front too. Obviously, the Turks don't really mind them at all, would be happy to have the Islamic State on their southern border, apparently, so, or an al-Nusra one or whatever. But they just can't do that because of the politics of Iran and Iran's relationship with Syria. And so they'll just muddle on like this and let the Islamic State continue to exist under a low-scale bombing campaign from now on? Is that basically it?
Well, I think that there is, and I've said this many times on your show, but I think that you've sort of zeroed in on the problem a bit more concretely, and I think it's worth discussing it in more concrete terms now than we have before, and that is the point of that is most relevant here, that the White House is indeed subject to some conflicting political forces at work, political pressures coming from different directions. I mean, you know, we've already talked about the, you know, the sort of domestic politics of, you know, sort of using the lack of adequate use of force against the White House by Republicans. And at the same time, you're absolutely right that the Middle East allies of the United States are not at all eager to prioritize the sort of destruction or even the significant weakening of the Islamic State over the problem of either getting rid of Assad or weakening Iran. You know, both of them were part of the same package. So it's true of all of the Middle East allies of the United States, Israel, Turkey, for various reasons, Israel, Turkey, Saudi Arabia, and the other Gulf states where the United States has military bases. They're all in the same boat here of wanting to do whatever is possible to weaken Iran. If not, you know, in the case of Israel, I mean, they're more or less openly saying we want regime change. That's still our objective. So, yes, there are conflicting pressures on the White House with regard to the policy toward the Islamic State. And so it's very clear that that when the military takes this position, that they do not want to have boots on the ground against Islamic State. That this is extremely compatible with the interests of the White House at this point. This is a position that the White House is perfectly happy with. For one thing, it gives the White House cover with regard to the Republicans, right? I mean, this is a perfect solution from the White House point of view.
Right. So, in other words, let me do this nuclear deal, and I promise to still be absolutely horrible on Syria and Yemen.
Right.
Well, that makes
good
sense.
And to look the other way at your connivance with the Islamic State in the case of Turkey, and to some extent the Gulf states, and with regard to al-Nusra, the open political and financial support of the Gulf states with regard to the al-Nusra Front, which is, I would argue, and I think it's fair to say that this is becoming the dominant view of specialists looking at Syria, they have become the primary force that endangers the Assad regime.
Mm-hmm. All right, now the Assad regime.
Assume
for me for a minute, for the sake of argument, that they do get the Iran nuclear deal through. Is that going to make the crisis with the Saudis and their anti-Iranian position that much worse? Or
are they going to, like, I would say they should breathe a sigh of relief that, oh, good, their nuclear program is more safeguarded than ever before. So, no problem.
No, they're not going to take that position because I think it's very clear that the nuclear program was never really the issue for the enemies of Iran in the region. That was a proxy for the much broader issue, the much deeper issue of basically Iran as a threat to their legitimacy, a threat to their power. And of course, it varies in the case of Israel versus Saudi, what the precise characteristics of the concern is or has been. But in both cases, you know, the fear and or you know, desire to weaken Iran has roots that have little to do with the nuclear program. I mean, you know, we know that the Israelis, you know, were threatening to attack Iran, but primarily using that threat to get the United States to attack Iran, you know, not so much for the nuclear program itself, but simply to basically deal a serious blow to the overall power position of Iran in the region, to make Iran a much less a powerful entity in the Middle East. So I think that's what this is really all about. And of course, the Saudi element adds the Sunni-Shia conflict and the Saudi also the Saudi fear of being overthrown from within, within Saudi Arabia. There's just a terribly irrational fear and trembling in the Saudi government that that adds another dimension to this that has really increased enormously since the Arab Spring in 2011. Mm-hmm. So that is definitely a big part of the picture. And again, I just think that the nuclear program is the excuse more than it is the real reason for the policies of really, in the case of Israel, trying to bring about regime change, or at the very least weaken Iran, and in the case of the Saudis, basically to, from their point of view, to defeat any force in the region that is allied with or associated with the Iranians from their point.
Yep. Hey, all right, now your audio is getting a little inconsistent on me there, Gareth. I'm not sure if you're holding the phone funny or something like that, maybe. So secondly, you have this new piece about the PMD we've talked about, the possible military dimensions and whether Iran has to quote-unquote fess up to all the things that they've been accused of in a bunch of Israeli forgeries and so forth, as you've reported so well in your book and in all your articles. But do you think that ultimately this is going to break the deal? Can you give us your odds on the final nuclear deal being reached by the end of the month?
It's very difficult for me to make that call. I guess, you know, somebody put a gun to my head and said, what's the odds? Is it better than 50-50 or less than 50-50? I would say slightly better than 50-50, but only slightly and very low confidence. I have very low confidence, as the CIA would say, in that estimate.
And now, but so Kerry came out and said, hey, I'm climbing down from my ridiculous demand. Don't worry about it, everybody. Whatever happened to that?
When Kerry said he was climbing down from the demand, I think what he was doing was saying that we're gonna try to find a way to handle this so that you know, there's not going to be a meltdown of the negotiations. I think that what that means is that they're still you know, trying to find a formula that would satisfy both the Israelis, the Israeli lobby in Congress specifically, on one hand, and would be acceptable to the Iranians. I have my doubts about whether they can do that. And so I think that in the end they will be, you know, they will have a choice between accepting a climb down that is going to be obvious
on one hand, and calling, you know, walking away from the talks. And I don't know how they're going to handle it. I really don't.
All right, that's it. We're out of time. Thanks so much, Gareth. Appreciate it, man.
Thanks as always, Scott. Good to be back.
That's the great Gareth Porter, y'all. Manufactured Crisis is the book.